Before we have a cup of tea, I just want to see if collectively we can recap at least on a few of the points that I was making a couple of weeks ago. So not all of you were here, but I know some of you were. And I was talking about wisdom as practiced by the Bodhisattva. Wisdom is realized in its fullness by the Buddha. The wisdom, in a way, that is the goal, you could say, of the whole of the spiritual life as conceived by Buddhism. And I guess I was starting from the premise that that the Buddha started from, which is that we cause ourselves and other people unnecessary pain in life because we're not aware of how things really are, because we're deluded. Buddhism starts, if you like, from this notion of fundamental delusion of every being that is unenlightened. So apart from the enlightened beings, me and probably most of you are deluded at some level or other. And because we don't see things as they are, that delusion causes us to be in a sort of slightly drunken state and act stupidly. And that stupidity, that blindness, means that we keep bumping into life, into things, into each other, in ways that cause pain. There's inevitable kind of pain in life to do with just having a body, and that body growing old or getting sick or eventually dying. That's a sort of given that we've got a body, although Buddhism does have a perspective on why we've got a body in the first place. And actually it says we've got a body in the first place because we were deluded in our previous life. And whether you can accept that model of previous lives and rebirth or not, in a way isn't so relevant, although I will come back to that, for looking at delusion in this life. But yes, Buddhism traditionally would say that that delusion doesn't have a beginning. It's the reason that we've taken on a body form, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, as if we don't realise that having a body is a painful thing. Of course, it's not entirely a painful thing. We can talk about that. But that the fact that it's not entirely a painful thing kind of just adds to the delusion, adds to the whole problem, the whole catastrophe, as you can say. And so I was talking a little bit about the way things are, or the way things the Buddha saw, the way things he said things are, the way things that we're trying to wake up to, the way things are. So can anybody remember any of the points about that? What was I saying about the way things are rather than the way things we normally experience or perceive? Depending on how much we remember will depend on whether I recap the whole evening or whether we move on. Yes, sure.
So you talked a bit about the kind of that we put labels on things all the time and try and define things, and that doesn't really talk about the reality of everything being connected.
I think one of the I'll come on to the interconnected bit later. But the labelling, I think, is really important. Well, they're both important, but the labelling thing first. You're right that we put labels on things, which isn't a problem so much. You know, I can call this a glass, or a sound that you might hear, you might label it car sound or whatever it is. It's not a problem for everyday life to label things. In fact, it seems to be a distinct evolutionary advantage to be able to label things. Our capacity to label things, particularly the use of language, and then concepts arising from language, increasingly abstract concepts arising from language, has led to human beings being phenomenally successful in sort of evolutionary terms, at least so far. So from an everyday perspective, labelling is just great. If you couldn't label anything, or you started to lose the capacity to label things, that would be a real problem. I guess for people who are approaching dementia or are in dementia, they lose that capacity, don't they, sometimes, to name and label. So they're in this world where experience is happening, but they lose the sort of the parameters of that, any sense of what's happening. A friend of mine was telling me about an elderly parent who was looking at, he found his mum looking at the light bulb and looking at it, saying, how do I get it to come on? And the capacity to make connections, label, have conceptual connections and understanding, very, very useful. Yeah. So very, very useful. Unfortunately, what we do is we mistake the label for the actual thing itself or the actual experience. So what I do is I pick up this and I say glass of water, as if that completely captures the experience. And when we do that, we narrow the experience, we solidify it, we concretize it, and we stop actually experiencing what's really there. We assume that we know what glass is, we assume we know what water is, we assume we know what the experience is. And actually experience, real experience, any experience, can never be defined and bounded and captured by any concept. All experience is beyond any conceptual categorization that we can put on it, any net of concepts, any words. So it means that we don't actually see or experience our experience fully, as it really is. So yes, labelling limits experience from an enlightened perspective. Or at least, not the labelling so much as mistaking the label for the thing itself. It's quite a subtle thing. The labelling's not so bad. It's the labelling, mistaking the labelling for the thing itself. So what's the biggest label the most fundamental problem that I was talking about? If you get it right, I'll let you go for tea. Knut, who wasn't there. Paul.
Me?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you.
That is the label, me.
Ah, yes, me. Yes, well done. You. Me. Oh, me. Exactly. Exactly. So thankfully, we'll be able to have a cup of tea. It's the fundamental kind of issue here is that I label all this experience that, is happening as mine. And somewhere in that mine, I have a sense that there's a real me. Somewhere in my experience, there's a me having the experience. Yeah? A real me. Apart from the experience, standing apart from the experience, behind the experience, having the experience. And when you start to think, well, what does that me look like, or what is that me? It becomes increasingly difficult to define. And Buddhism would say that's because it doesn't exist. It's a notion, it's a label. We have experience, we simplify that experience in a particular way, we concretize it in a particular way, we assume that there's an internal aspect of that experience with a real me having that, and an external aspect of that experience that we call the outer world, that exists, as it were, independent of me. And that's the fundamental delusion, that there's a real me and there's a real outer world. So on that note, let's have a cup of tea, and then I'll say more. Okay, good. So, to resume, so that we've talked about how the fundamental problem is that we are mistaking our experience in a very profound pre-conscious way, and that fundamental mistake is that we assume there's a real me having the experience and a real objective world that is being experienced. And of course that's fine for conventional everyday terms, but it's not fine if we really want to wake up to the way things are. And I'm arguing that we do want to wake up to the way things are, because that is a liberation from all unnecessary pain, all unnecessary suffering. It is freedom, bliss, creativity, expansiveness. It's our true birthright as human beings, to wake up to the way things really are. And one of the ways that I was saying, well, I was trying to convince you last time I spoke that this is true. Firstly, I was saying if you look internally, particularly in meditation, if you look internally at your experience inside you, well, what do you find? What do you find when you meditate? What sort of things happen? You don't need to be too specific. What sort of categories of things happen?
Energy movements.
Yeah. So some things in the body, you mean?
Yeah, just feel like buzz, or it doesn't feel like sometimes the body disappears. It just goes kind of pulse.
Yeah.
Spirals.
Yeah. So sensations in the body.
Yes.
Sensations in the body, that's right. So we notice those, that's good. What else do we notice?
How busy our mind is.
Yeah.
Preoccupations.
Thoughts. Sometimes they're images in the mind. Thoughts, preoccupations, concerns. Yeah, images. Maybe we could just say thoughts and images in the mind. What else do we sometimes notice?
Emotions.
Yes.
Yes,
emotions. Those emotions come in a huge variety of flavours, don't they? And subtleties and layers. And sometimes, if we're particularly aware, we can feel the emotion as a sensation in the body, as well as perhaps thoughts in the mind or images in the mind. Yeah. So that's pretty good, isn't it? Bodily sensations, thoughts, images, emotions. Emotions in Buddhism have a volitional component, so there's some sort of willing that we experience. There's a volition, a sense of directionality, of wanting, of not wanting. That is an aspect of our experience. Yeah? Yeah.
Does goodwill or matter, does it come from thought? Or is it only one thought?
Metta can come from thought, it can be a well-wishing. It's normally associated particularly with a volition, but it can be sparked by a thought or an image or even a physical kind of sensation. So yes, metta can cover all of those things. But the point I'm going to try and make is that those sensations, thoughts, images, volitions that we have, all the time we're having them, they're all transient, they're all always changing, they're always moving, they're dynamic. And behind them, there's no static entity called me that's apart from the thoughts, the volitions, the sensations, the emotions, the images. Yeah? It's as if when I think of me, I am just a term for that set of experiences. But I tend to think that somehow I'm a real entity apart from the experience. And that causes suffering in a minute. I'll say why. Then similarly, the outside world. So here you see a bell, you've got walls, you've got room, etc. A room, you've got a shrine, a Buddha image, flowers, candles, all the things that mats and cushions and other people, they're all within our visual field. But what Buddhism would say is that what I've just described is just a set of labels. When you think of wall or flower or bell, actually it's just a label for some sort of phenomenon that is dynamic. Now the wall and the bell may not look very dynamic, but when you look more closely, perhaps when you look from a microscopic, subatomic perspective, you'll see, or you would know, that it is all dynamic. There's nothing static there. And one of the fundamental teachings of the Buddha was that it's always changing. There is no thing there. So when we say flower, actually there's a phenomenon going on. We've just conveniently given it a label and sort of categorised it, and then we don't have to think about it. But actually there's a dynamic phenomenon always going on. This flower is in dynamic relationship with its environment, with the air, with the room, etc., etc. And that's true of all things. Then I was also saying, so there's this dynamic way of looking at things, and then I was also saying that another way of analysing things is to break them into their component parts. And what Buddhism would say is that any object, so-called object, that you can think about or experience, you can break down into smaller and smaller parts. And there'll be no limit to how small you can go. And you'll never arrive at something that is fundamentally that object. It will just start breaking down into sort of energy, really. It'll completely disappear. You can see it with some things. You can watch a cloud and know that actually it's just a transient thing and it's disappearing. You can analyse something like a car and know that it's just the sum of its parts. So if you break down analytically a car, you end up with bits of engine and door and seats and whatever it is, and nowhere is there an actual thing called car. Car is just a concept that we've applied to a temporary assemblage of other things. Yeah. Car doesn't exist apart from as a concept. Charles?
Where do we go with this?
Sorry?
Where do we go with this?
Oh, you have to wait. You have to wait. You have to wait.
I don't think I'm being impatient. I mean, it seems I'm feeling myself that things are talking about, and I think on it, you know, quite often, oh yeah, this ends, nothing's the same.
Sure.
This wall isn't a wall.
Sure.
You know, everyone's going to die. Well,
sure. Let me come back to that. When I say you have to wait, you won't have to wait very long.
Okay.
But I will come on to that. I just want to pursue this analysis a little bit further in a way to... What I want to try and do is undermine our common sense way of looking at the world. And then I want to say where and how we work with that. So one way of undermining our common sense of view of the world is just reflecting that everything is dynamic and fluid and changing. Another way of undermining our common sense view of so-called objective things is to recognise that they're just made up of smaller and smaller parts, and that labels are just conventional terms. But I think there's a deeper way of looking at of objects. Can anybody remember what I was talking about when I talked a couple of weeks ago about our...
Functional concepts.
Sorry?
We're talking about functional concepts.
Yes, I was talking about functional concepts.
We see things, but they're just really functional concepts.
Yeah, 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 they're just functional concepts. I think what I was trying to get at is that our very senses aren't telling us the truth of things. Our very senses aren't revealing the way things are. So it's easy, this applies to all five senses, and it also applies to the mind. But it's easy to see with just one sense. So I'm going to take the sense of sight. And so you can everybody see the flowers on the shrine? There's some yellow chrysanthemums there. And so you can see these flowers, so-called. And when you look, one of the things that sort of presents itself is colour and shape. Yeah? Colour and shape. There's probably not much else, unless you come and touch or smell the flower, that you can... If you're sitting near the front, you might be able to smell. But unless you can smell the flower, probably it's just colour and shape. And crudely, you could say it's yellow and green, but when you look a bit more closely, actually, there's loads of greens and loads of yellows in that. It's not so easily dismissed. If you were a painter, you'd notice the subtleties of colour and shape. But colour is... Well, what do we know about colour and perception of sight? What's really going on? Or what's going on more fundamentally?
Frequencies of light in the eye.
Yeah, who's...
So colour doesn't exist, does it?
No.
It's just your impression of your conversion of frequency of light into the eye that gives you a sense of colour.
Yeah, so
you
that's
can't
why...
tell whether somebody else actually... is experiencing that in a different way.
That's right, you can't tell. So, that's right. So, for this experience of colour, you've got somehow frequency of light, whatever that means. You've got to have an eye that can detect that frequency of light. And then you've got to have some sort of consciousness that can take that sense input and make sense of it. You know, our minds, our brains are processing the light waves, the photons that come in through the eye, turning them into electrical impulses that carry through the optic nerve, and then being processed somewhere in the brain. In the brain, where the brain cavity is, it's dark. There is no colour. Yeah? This experience that you're having is mind constructed, at least in part. Yellow isn't a characteristic of the flower. It's a condition that arises when you, with your eyes, meet whatever this flower really is. Yeah? And the experience is one of this colour. So if you were a different sort of animal, if you were a dog or a bat or something, your experience would be different. Even if you were colourblind, your experience would be different to somebody who wasn't colourblind. So we just say, oh yeah, yellow flower. But actually, yellow is an experience. It's not a property of the flower alone. It's an interactive thing, and yellow has arisen. The experience of yellow has arisen. Yeah? Does that make sense so far? So, that's just taking sight. But the same is true for all our senses. So last week I was saying touch. Last 2 weeks ago I was saying touch. So I can touch this singing bowl, this bell, and it feels very solid and cool. So there's sensations of temperature and sensations of resistance, of solidity, and the like. But I used to study physics, and I know that actually there's nothing solid here, that the atoms that make this up are almost entirely empty space. Almost entirely empty space. And the only reason that I can't just, that my hand just doesn't pass through the bell, the only reason that I don't sort of interpenetrate with this object is that on the surface of my hand, the atoms contain electrons. On the surface of the bell, the atoms contain electrons. And electrons repel other electrons because of something called the electromagnetic force. So the surface of the electrons on the surface of the bell are repelling the electrons on the surface of my skin, and that is what I experience as solidity. A truer description would be that this is empty space, mostly empty space, and so is my hand. And the two, theoretically, if you just looked at empty space without taking into account electromagnetic repulsion, you'd just walk through walls. Yeah? So solidity is an illusion. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's an illusion that arises in dependence upon the sort of body we have, and in a way, our construct. It's a construct of experience. So that's the felt sense, and you could go on with sound, with smell, taste. Yeah.
So how's your mind constructed that, though? Because you physically can't put your hand through the bell.
So my mind has created a notion of solidity. That's what the mind has created. You're right that the mind hasn't created necessarily the fact that there's resistance. But all there is in experience is resistance. The notion of solidity is a notion that's mind-made. Yeah? It's that's mind-made, the solidity. So we take lots of objects around us as so-called solid. If you could really see it, you'd see it as much more dynamic, flowing arrangements of energy. So far what I've just argued is that this internal experience of me is a construct, or the me bit of it is a construct, and the external world, as we experience it, is constructed. It's constructed, and then we take that constructed experience for absolute reality. So, where is this going, as Giles very eloquently asked? Well, what the Buddha taught is that it's because we take these constructs for absolute reality, that what we do is, one of the fundamental things we do is that we think that the me that is the construct is real, and then we try and cling to that construct of me. So I construct this notion of Jnanavacha, and when asked, what do you mean by Jnanavacha, I'll probably say body, emotions, thoughts, volitions, memories, whatever. But I construct this notion as if there's an independent Jnanavacha wandering through all of that, having all of that, as if I'm an unchanged entity having all of that experience. And then what I do is I try and protect that so-called me. And it's just a construction. But I protect what can't be protected because it doesn't really exist. It's a construction. I protect it fiercely from anything that threatens that sense of self. And, well, particularly in my case, I crave anything that boosts that sense of self. So you get this dynamic of greed and hatred, of pulling towards you things that you think will be pleasurable or boost your sense of self, pushing away things that you think will threaten that sense of self. And fundamentally, because it's a construction, it can't be protected. It can't be shored up because it isn't really there. And of course that causes us anxiety, because somewhere in the background of our mind, we kind of know that. We know that our bodies are gradually falling apart. We know that there's nothing that we can hold on to. We know that any experience we have is temporary, is transient. We know that objects that we cling to, even other people that we cling to, are transient phenomena. We know that somewhere, but we try and ignore it. But of course, reality keeps breaking through. It keeps breaking through when things don't go to plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Those objects are... Well, I had my laptop stolen a few years ago, and it was my laptop, and now it was somebody else's. So there you go. It was a construct that didn't quite go to plan. My hair falls out. That wasn't part of the plan. And once it's fallen out, is it me anyway? What is that down there in the bath or whatever? That doesn't feel like me. More seriously, we experience loss in terms of bereavement. People die. People that we love and hold on to and think of as ours die. Or they leave us. And then eventually we know that we will die and leave everything else and everyone else. So all of that causes fear and anxiety. And our response to fear and anxiety is to cling ever more tightly, push away what threatens, look the other way, anaesthetize ourselves with drink, drugs, television, whatever it is, not actually look at what's going on. And all the time, we live in a narrower and narrower sense of me, a sense that isolates me from the world. Yeah. What the Buddha says is, if you can start to see the construction, what naturally happens is that clinging starts to loosen. That clinging starts to, just soften. There's less and less of a sense of me as a separate entity that's apart from you and you and the rest of the universe. There's just more and more of a sense of free-flowing experience that's happening and arising all the time. When that happens, when we start to let go of clinging, well, something miraculous seems to happen. And how Subhuti was putting it last week was that consciousness unfolds. Consciousness unfolds. So when consciousness unfolds, it's as if we experience a sense of freedom, of lightness, of being able to move with things without resisting our experience all the time. There's normally a sense of metta that naturally arises, rather than us having to do 5 stages of effort. Metta just feels natural because we don't feel so isolated and separate from other living beings. So metta feels a natural response. Fear diminishes. We feel a natural confidence in, not in ourselves, but just in life and the dynamic flow of life. We're willing to go with that and let that do its thing. So fear of trying to control our experience. When we try and control our experience, there's fear. If you stop trying to control your experience, the fear diminishes. So the more we let go of this self-clinging, the more expansive, creative, free, joyous, even blissful, loving, connected, our experience becomes. Energy arises because That self-clinging, that holding on to me, takes a lot of effort to manage the anxiety, the existential anxiety, the isolation, the loneliness, takes a lot of effort. All of that effort is unnecessary. You let go, it's energy. It frees itself up. Hatred stops arising, or at least you can experience it diminishing, and then finally it can stop. Hatred is all about pushing away things that threaten us. If there's no sense of needing to be protected, there's no sense of threat. And you start to see that, besides, when other people behave in so-called sort of obnoxious ways, they're doing it because they're clinging. It's still based in their delusion. You start to empathise a bit more with other people. So empathy and connectedness replace hatred and fear. So ultimately, there's no... And yes, just to say, there's no limit to this direction of unfoldment, of unfolding consciousness. It's as if it's open-ended. Ultimately, a Buddha, an enlightened being, would have no sense of being a separate entity. They would have no sense of a me. Of course, they would still see yellow chrysanthemums. They would still have experience of solidity. It's not like they'd just walk through walls or, you know, it's not... They'd still have their sense experience as long as they had a body and were alive, but they wouldn't mistake that sense experience for reality. They'd be living in a way where they knew that this was a sort of mirage that was presenting itself, but wasn't the real thing. An analogy that the Buddha used was that it's dreamlike. When you're having a dream, you are having experience. But all of that experience, if you have a dream where, you know, I had a dream where I was in this big, a couple of nights ago, a big sort of slightly ramshackle hotel with beautiful gardens, and Subhuti was showing me round. All of that, in the dream, felt really vivid and real, and we were having a conversation and whatever. When I wake up, I realise it's mind-created. It was a construct, yeah? It was a construct, and it had validity as long as it lasted. It might have even had significance. But compared to waking reality, it's not fully real. It's not as real. Well, the Buddha would see our ordinary waking reality in a dreamlike way. He'd say, compared to enlightened experience, this normal experience isn't as real. It's relatively real, like a dream is relatively real compared to waking reality. Well, waking ordinary day reality, common sense reality, is relatively real, but not absolutely real compared to what an enlightened being would experience. Yeah.
One of the things I've experienced when you get that sort of expansion of your consciousness and things like that on retreat. What I find then is that I just start to go, oh, let's look at that experience that I've just had, and then I just take that on as me.
That's right. Yeah, we appropriate it. It's one of the ironies of this construction, if you want to call it ego. We'll call it ego for just time being, not in a technical sense, but it's one of the ironies of this egotistical way of being, that the expansion arises when you let go of the egotistical way of being. But then when the egotistical way of being returns, it says, wow, didn't we have an expansive time? And it appropriates it. It appropriates it and says, I'm clever. I had a... you know, I know what Nyanavacha was talking about. I had an expansive time. So it's an irony that in the spiritual life, you have to keep working at letting go even of those really positive experiences. They just need to be let go of. If we cling to them, we just turn them into an even bigger sense of me. Yeah.
So what is it that's doing the letting go? I mean, why am I interested in listening to the Dharma?
Yes. Well, this is the sort of mystery. If you look for it, you can start to experience it, but you'll never find it. Buddhism talks about it in various ways. But what is it that is witnessing our experience, or wanting to practice in the first place, or doing the letting go, as you say? And different traditions, different forms of Buddhism have different metaphors for it. But that we are now dealing with metaphors, because whatever it is, it isn't an it, because if it's a thing, it would belong in the world of objects and subjects. And what I'm talking about, what the Buddha's talking about, what the Dharma's talking about, is that this whole notion of a really existing subject and really existing objects is the delusion. So then, when you say, what is it that allows us to step outside of that delusion, it can't be another object. Yeah? And it can't be another subject. Christianity or other theistic traditions would turn it into another object, and they'd say the ultimate object is God with a big G. Yeah? But from a Buddhist perspective, to talk in terms of God is still to be thinking in terms of subject and object. There's a real me and a real God. We're still bounded in that delusive framework. Unfortunately, language itself, our language, and all our conceptual faculty is bounded in this world of subject and object. It's not possible to construct any words or even have any thoughts that go beyond subject and object as a framework. Yeah? You can't have concepts beyond it. Concepts belong to that framework. So all you can have is metaphors. You can say as if. Yeah. So the metaphor that Subhuti was using in his rambles was consciousness. It's a metaphor, because there isn't a thing called consciousness, but he was using it because you have to use some word. So he was saying it's consciousness. And consciousness is unbounded, infinite. It's not my consciousness. There is just consciousness unfolding. And everything that we experience in space and time, all phenomena, are part of that.
Did he go so far as to say there is one consciousness?
He didn't say one, because that would imply an object. If you say one as opposed to many, yeah, you've gone into an object. So Buddhism doesn't say one. It says not two, though. It does say not two. Yeah? But to say one would be too much. Too much. Too definite. Too literal. As soon as we... Because numbers... The notion of number belongs in this subject-object framework. Yeah? So what I'm saying is that any conceptual grasp of it is a falsification of it. Even to say it's an it is a falsification. No words apply. So what Buddhism does is it uses metaphor. Yeah? But you've got to be really conscious that it's metaphor. So one of the metaphors that Bhante Sangharakshita has recently been using is that is of the suprapersonal force. So what this metaphor is saying is that when you get out of the way, when you let go of self-clinging, it's as if, and it isn't as if, because it's not literally real, it's as if you will experience, as if, a force coming through you, a force that is... alive, you'll experience as if there's a consciousness that's more than your own consciousness coming through you, and yet it's not an alien consciousness, it's somehow essentially who you are. So, and that force, that suprapersonal force, which is suprapersonal meaning it's more than personal, but not impersonal. That force will have the flavour of compassion, of love. It'll be a force for the alleviation of suffering, wanting to alleviate suffering. So it will be as if you will want to just alleviate suffering, but it won't feel like me doing it or you doing it. It'll be as if you've got out of the way and there's just compassionate activity. Yeah? That's one metaphor. The metaphor that Subhuti was using last week, as I say, was just this expanding, unfolding consciousness. Another metaphor is the image of the Buddha. An image of the Buddha that's just saying, this is what there is. This is what it's like. Obviously not literal. It's quite good to have an image of the Buddha because it's obviously not literal. It's obviously a symbol. And not just the Buddha here, but you've got in the Buddhist tradition Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in various forms and various beautiful colours with various symbolic implements, symbolising the sort of states of mind that arise when you let go of self-clinging. They're all trying to say, this is it. This is it. Another way of talking that one school of Buddhism uses is that everything is mind. That this phenomenal world is just manifestation of mind. But then you're back in this language of, is it my mind, your mind, one mind, big mind, mind of God? Whichever language you use, there's dangers if you take it literally. I like to think of just flowing energy. I think if the Buddha had had the term energy, in the sense that modern day science uses the term energy, he might have used it, who knows? That everything is just manifestation, forms of energy, and it's all dynamic. And none of it is completely separate from anything else. Buddhism uses the term emptiness, shunyata, to indicate that there's no essential thingness to things. Things. There's just dynamic, connected flow. It uses, other metaphors as well. So I saw two hands. Knut, you had your hand, and then you had your hand.
You said, where is suffering then? If it's all shunyata, where is the suffering that it's trying to alleviate?
Well, it's interesting that suffering, too, in a sense, doesn't exist in an absolute sense. If you think of the Heart Sutra, one of the lines in the Heart Sutra is, nor is there pain or cause of pain. And there it's referring to dukkha. The Buddha was saying his whole path was to alleviate dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. And the Heart Sutra comes along and says, there is no dukkha. Yeah? Because ultimately, even a concept like dukkha is just a concept. Yeah? It's just that while we, you and I, have got this deluded notion of a real me, dukkha is experienced. And if we let go of this notion of a real me, then our experience won't contain dukkha. But dukkha isn't a thing. Sorry?
It will contain this thing that wants to alleviate it.
Yes. So that's part of the paradox of Buddhism. What Buddhism says is that a bodhisattva, an enlightened being, knows that there's no real things out there, including no real beings. And yet, there's this compassionate response to alleviate suffering in the world. And that's a contradiction to our unenlightened minds, where we're just about able to maybe give assent to the fact that, yes, there are no fixed entities. Even that's just a very superficial cognitive assent, rather than a gut-level ascent. But what then the experience of the enlightened mind is that not only is there a deep vision that there's nothing fixed, there are no fixed entities, but there's this spontaneous outpouring of love and compassion to help those non-existent entities wake up. Yeah. It's a bit like, say, a friend of yours was having a nightmare. Yeah, your partner or friend was having a nightmare. You could leave them to have the nightmare. You know, in that nightmare, they might be being horribly tortured. You could leave them thinking, oh, well, it's not real. Nothing's really happening. No harm's going to come to them. Or you could wake them up and say it's all right. And the Buddha would try and wake us up. Do you see what I mean? You could say that the dream is not really real, but the compassionate thing to do would be to alleviate the suffering. That's an analogy. If you take the analogy too far, it doesn't hold, but that's the analogy. Yeah.
For unenlightened people, what's the essential difference between normal craving and like craving for attaining enlightenment, or clinging to the idea of enlightenment, clinging to normal things?
The difference is that one helps you and one doesn't help you. You're right that if I would like to move towards enlightenment, and that is still a craving, that's a wanting, that's a thirst. Chanda is the word, or tanha, for this sort of thirst. What the Buddha says is, yes, it's a thirst, it's a craving, but it's helpful, because where we are now, where I am now, I need to, in order to see things as they really are, I need to do something. And in order to motivate that action, I need to have a sense of a goal, and a sense that that goal is really worth attaining. Yeah? So any sense of motivation, thirst, craving for a liberating goal is helpful. Ultimately, we'll have to let go of even wanting to attain enlightenment. If we're going to attain enlightenment, we're going to have to let go of even the notion of enlightenment, let alone wanting it. We're going to have to let go of any sort of wanting, and I'm going to have to let go of any notion that I can attain anything. Because remember, the whole point is that I'm trying to see through the delusion of me. So me wanting something is part of that deluded framework. Yeah? But if we do that too early, if I were to do that now, in my current state of spiritual development, then I wouldn't make any progress. Yeah? So it's like we need goals, and we need to cultivate this thirst and momentum to attain that goal, before we can let go of any notion of goals and anyone to attain it. Yeah? And Buddhism's quite sophisticated. So on the one hand it says, wake up, you are suffering unnecessarily. Here's a path. Act more skillfully, meditate more, reflect more, look at your views, undermine your common sense assumptions, be a friend to people, be kind, develop metta, act from that, cultivate selflessness, you will grow. On the one hand, it's saying all of that. And then you get these wisdom teachings, like the Heart Sutra, which say there's nothing to attain, no one to attain it. There are no goals. Yeah? But if you take that wrongly, you don't make the progress. Yeah? And I think in Western Buddhist circles, you get lots of books saying there's nothing to do. Just be. Just be, because any notion of a goal is falsifying things. Just chill. And unfortunately, most people, I'm not saying everybody, because some people might experience genuine spiritual insight through chilling. But for most of us, nothing happens. And we carry on behaving in our self-centered, egocentric, deluded ways. And what's worse is that we've now got a book telling us that that's great, and that's the real truth. Yeah. So we've just made matters worse. So we mustn't give up on the notion of goals, of wanting to attain those goals too early. Yeah. I'll take one more and then we really must stop. Peter.
Oh, thanks. It's just in following on that. Because I've been thinking a lot about aspirations mm. the last week and motivations got prompted by someone else.
Yeah.
And my mum.
thanks for acknowledging that.
Yeah, two of them.
This has been recorded and it's going to be on the internet, Peter. So you might want to say hi to your mum.
And so is it almost like saying that we're using our sense of self, even though we know in the long term it's not actually real?
Yeah.
Kind of, and in the same way with goals, like aspirations in life, but we know that it's not the real deal almost, but we're using it in order to keep ourselves.
Yeah, that puts it really well. That's so good. That is what the law of karma is all about. The law of karma is saying that you've got a sense of self, even though that's a delusion. If you use that sense of self skillfully, creatively, then you will grow. Consciousness will start to unfold. If you use it unskillfully, you'll contract. Consciousness will shrink and become more tight and painful. So use this delusion of self in a skillful, intelligent, creative way, according to the law of karma, that will help us grow. Ultimately, we'll have to see through the whole delusion, the whole shebang. But we can only do that on the basis of a consciousness that's already fairly expansive, not very tight, positive, emotionally positive, i.e. full of metta and shraddha. Shraddha I haven't talked about, but it's confidence that if we let go of self-clinging, something more will arise, rather than we'll just die or enter into some vacuum or black hole. So shraddha is a confidence that there's a reality beyond self-clinging. So if you use the law of karma to cultivate a mind that is expansive, flexible, pliable, creative, emotionally positive, got some metta, got some shraddha. You use study like this, or discourse like this, or engagement with the conceptual aspect of the Dharma to start reflecting on the way things are. You bring those reflections onto a very concentrated, positive, expansive mind, and then you've got a chance of letting go of the fundamental delusion. When you do that, some new processes that are Dharma Niyama processes arise, that aren't categorised by the law of karma, which is categorised by self. So something new arises. But there's effort to be made until that point. Yeah? So Sangharakshita favours the path of growth. I mean, the metaphor, the language of growth. He says basically we can grow. And not only can we grow, that is the call, the urge for all life. Growth is its natural mode. When we identify with a narrow sense of me, I'm inhibiting growth of consciousness. So to expand that sense of me is an expansion of consciousness, and that growth is always fulfilling, even if it's uncomfortable. It's always more life. And more life is what Buddhism's all about. Go on, you can ask, but I might not answer.
So is that sort of the central purpose in that sense of growth, in terms of you to break everything down?
That's one language.
The sort of energy, the purpose of that energy is to grow.
That's one way of thinking about it. Remember, you're using metaphors. We're using metaphors. But yes, that's one way of thinking about it. That everything... A poetic image that Buddhism sometimes uses is the whole cosmos is evolving towards enlightenment. That's... Yeah, but that is a very, very poetic way of thinking, and you mustn't think that therefore I can just lie back in my bed and let the cosmos do it for me, which is a danger. But Sangharakshita does sometimes, very occasionally, use those sorts of poetic languages with lots and lots of caveats and cautions and saying, don't take it literally. But yeah, you could say that somehow, inherently, everything wants to flower into Buddhahood. That Buddhahood is the purpose of reality. It's reality becoming conscious of itself in human form.
Could you then say that everything will become?
No.
Would that not be the logical conclusion to everything moving towards it?
And that's why that's a dangerous metaphor to use. That's exactly why. Because what the Buddha said is that although the enlightenment is an ever-present potential possibility, delusion is also an ever-present potential possibility. So you one of the things he's, if you take on board the rebirth teaching, he's saying we've lived for countless lives, all of us, going round and round, taking on a form, taking on a body, identifying with it, trying to fulfill our desires, failing ultimately to fulfill our desires, suffering as a result of that craving, dying, and then doing it all again. Okay. Imagine countless adolescences. So the Buddhist vision traditionally is that. So it won't just happen automatically. There isn't some sort of... it takes effort. Yeah, one more.
I've just got this feeling of be of this world, but not in this world.
Right.
I think that's what I'm
picking
up from teaching.
That might be a good way of thinking about it. But all I'd say is that in order to do that, it's not a simple thing of let's just hang out and be... it takes practice and it takes effort. Yeah. Should we leave it there?
Yeah.
All right. Good luck. Thank you.